The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian sitting areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when their travels bring them to Washington. For more information, visit www.tabardinn.com.
By Fred Ebb and John Kander, orchestrated by Don Costa, and stolen by me. Start spreading the news. I am leaving today.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides and
Carol Butler.
The show The Naturalist. We're back on the air. And Carol has been on the air while I've been gone. Is that right, Carol?
Well, we played an old show.
Oh, right.
We've been catching up. I've been busy with bed bugs while you're gone.
Oh, that's right. Carol's new book is on bed bugs, and I'm sure it's going to be a bestseller.
Well, we hope so. I spent the weekend working on everything you ever want to know about bed bug bites and actually diseases, but they don't transmit any diseases, which is nice.
Oh, that's good.
There's a lot of research they have the poor bed bugs feed on a blood meal that's loaded with hepatitis B virus or loaded with HIV virus, but fortunately, they don't transmit it, so that's nice. But I waded through a lot of research on that. But that was not the only thing I did this weekend.
Good. Okay, and I'm just back from Belize, where I went with my partner Janet, and I'll talk about that. That'll be a next week's show. And I met a lot of nice folks, did recordings, and generally had a good time. But Carol, you went on a trip this weekend with Audubon, was it?
Right. Yeah. That's why we used that lovely New York music to start off with. I had a wonderful day. It was one of those trips I was saying to Bernie before we began. Once in a while you do something and you don't know how it's going to turn out, and it just turns out to be terrific. And I went on a winter cruise with sponsored by the New York City Audubon chapter. And we went on a water taxi out from Pier 17 at South Street Seaport on Saturday. And the weather was absolutely gorgeous. It couldn't have been nicer for a winter day. And we went in Lower Manhattan Harbor, and the idea was to see seals. Now, our faithful listeners may remember that Bernie and I went out to Montauk on a trip to see seals and didn't see any. And it was very cold. We were freezing on the beach looking for seals. And here I was on this beautiful boat, very comfortable. And we went out into the harbor into places that I never knew existed. I'm sure Bernie has been there and knows and will tell us about it. We went under the Verrazano Bridge. I put a picture just to show you what a beautiful day it was. You'll see it on the website. And the guide for the trip was Gabriel Willow, who was absolutely wonderful, very, very nice guy, very knowledgeable. And even the captain on the boat was wonderful. They was very sensitive to our desire to see the seals and the birds and not to disturb them. And he slowed down and turned the boat around and was really like you were in your own little rowboat, just hanging out, doing what you wanted to do. So we first went to Red Hook, where IKEA is, to see the birds there. And then we went out under the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, and I discovered that there are artificial islands out there.
A lot of landfill on those islands, right?
Very old. Yeah. Hoffman is one, and the other one is Swinburne. They created in 1860, and they were used to quarantine immigrants in the early 20th century who were found to be carrying contagious diseases when they were processed through Ellis Island. And it was used for the last cholera outbreak. The last time it was used was 1910-1911. And on Swinburne, there's a crematorium, which I put a photograph of on the website just because it's unbelievable to think about. They used that they would take the bodies of the people who were killed in the cholera epidemic and put them in the crematorium. Cremate them, that's what I'm looking to say. Mm-hmm. So, and that island is the seal haul-out for the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gabriel said it's never for sure that you're going to see seals or not. And when we were at Red Hook, we had that same kind of experience. We actually saw it, which I didn't even see in Montauk, where somebody says, oh, there's a seal, you know, and you see a little bump in the water. And they say, you know, oh, that's it, it's shiny, and then it dives.
Mm-hmm.
And then we turned the boat around trying to see if it came up. I sort of did see a little bump in the water, but these are frustrating experiences for me.
Well, they have to come up someplace, those
seals.
Yeah,
right. But when we got out to Swinburne, there was a bunch of them on the rocks.
Oh, good.
And I sent a photograph. It was a little hard to see, but you can see in the photograph there are three or four sunning on the rocks. And then I got the one shot of a close-up. Which was terrific. He picked his head up, or she picked her head up, and you really can see the face and the whole thing very clearly. But it was very exciting to actually find these seals right off Wall Street, you know, right in
at least off Brooklyn.
Off Brooklyn, yeah. But I mean, you know.
Red Hook is a trendy neighborhood now, so maybe those seals were looking for a place to stay.
Right. Well, they're evidently migrating through, right?
Okay. Yeah, I think they're here in the winter.
Yes.
And that's it.
Because Gabriel said there in the further north, the water is frozen,
mm-hmm.
and so they can't fish.
Yeah.
And in the harbor, the water is all open, so they have plenty. And also, the harbor is much cleaner,
mm-hmm.
and so there's much more food for them. So it's a good... And the seal flock? What do you call a group of seals?
Hungry.
Okay. Has increased in size.
I'll have to think of that. My head's still in Belize
with
the dolphins.
Okay. So we didn't see any dolphins.
No, I didn't think so.
And then we saw a bunch of birds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm a nouvelle birder. So I have difficulty, especially with the water birds, where, you know, a million miles away there's a duck and everybody gets very excited because it's this kind of duck. Sorry, Audubon folks, but I'm not sophisticated enough yet. I can tell you about hummingbirds and I can tell you about birds of prey, but otherwise I'm sort of limited. But we saw a double-crested cormorant, which created a lot of excitement.
Mm-hmm.
I put a photograph of that on as well. It had a white patch on the side, and when I looked it up, I didn't see any of the subspecies that have a white patch, but Bernie knows about that. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, the double-crested cormorant, we have a lot of them. It's an ordinary bird these days. I mean, years ago they were not so numerous, but now they're all over the place. But the one that you saw was, I think, a great cormorant, it's mm-hmm. called, because it's bigger than the double-crested. And it has that white patch, I think, in its developmental stage. I don't know if they have it as adults. I don't remember. But I know that probably Gabriel got excited when he saw it because it's uncommon.
I guess that's right, yeah. It's very big.
Mm-hmm.
It's a couple of feet long.
Yeah, it's bigger than the regular cormorant.
And it's black.
Right.
I don't know if all cormorants are black.
All
are
cormorants
all black?
Are black, yeah. There's another one, the olivicus, mm-hmm. I think that's how you say it, cormorant. But the double-crested is the most common one that we see in the Northeast and all over the place.
Right. And online they say, like you do, that it's no big deal, that they were threatened by DDT, but the numbers have increased markedly, and they're almost a pest at this point.
Right.
But we only saw one, and it caused a big fuss.
Yeah,
so
the one you saw was the unusual one.
Right, okay, maybe. But we didn't even see other kinds. We saw lots of gulls.
Yeah.
I've learned not to say seagulls, which is what we called them in the Bronx when I was growing up. Now
everything
I know,
was a seagull.
I know they're gulls, and we talked about the different types of gulls.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of other shorebirds. There were a lot of birds. And interestingly, a lot of birds that you only see in the winter in New York Harbor. So I really would recommend they do this kind of cruise in the summer as well, but it's a terrific thing to do. It would sort of be understandable in the summer that it would be lovely, but to do it in the winter was just fabulous.
Yeah, especially on a nice day.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, I did that trip with Audubon in the summer.
Right.
And we went from Swinburne and Hoffman back up the East River
mm-hmm.
to see on Big Brother Island, and there's another few islands where we have nesting shorebirds.
That's right. We they talked
great
about
egrets
that.
And
right.
snowy egrets and all those shorebirds.
But those birds were all with you in Belize this time of year.
Well, not all of them. The smart ones were.
The smart ones.
Some of the ones are not that smart. They stick around.
Right. Well, they because he said that mostly they had migrated.
Right. Sure.
What's interesting about the cormorants, is that they are not waterproof like a lot of water birds.
Mm-hmm.
What's the name for water birds? There's a good name that I never knew what it meant.
Don't remember
I'll
that.
Think of it. Yes, you know it. All right. But birds that spend most of their time in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But all the Audubon people are now shouting that word, which I can't think of.
Oh, good. Let them call in or send us a... On our comments.
Send us an email on our comments page, right? We'll think of it as soon as the show is finished. Okay, but they mainly eat fish and they hunt by swimming and diving, but the feathers aren't waterproof, and so they have to spend time drying them out after fishing, which is just interesting for a seabird.
Yeah.
So as you see in my photograph, it's perched on top of a piling. And it was fluttering its feathers and, you know, drying itself off.
You have its wings out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It did that for us. We were very...
Of course.
It was sitting still, but then it did that. It spread the wings and flapped them. It was very exciting.
Yeah, they do that all the time to dry their wings out.
I'm sorry, Cal.
I know it was just for you.
You're making it sound very ordinary. For me, it was a very big deal.
I'm glad. That's good.
I really had a wonderful time.
Good.
I was very thrilled. And I like it when I can see them. So you're up close. The cormorant was nice because we got up close, and it's a big bird, so it was easy to see. I had the binoculars you gave me, and I had my camera, and so I was really able to enjoy it, where with a lot of the gulls and the other faraway little birds, I'm struggling to find them.
Well, just one thing about the cormorant, why I sound so blasé.
Yeah.
When I was working in the naturalist program, you know, we had this schooner, 85-foot long schooner, and... We used to dock it offshore at night, you know, tie it up to a mooring. And we'd come back in the morning, and there was all this stuff on the deck all over. It wasn't poop.
Mm-hmm.
They regurgitate
stuff.
They chew it up, and whatever they don't digest, I guess they spit it out.
Interesting.
So we'd come out in the morning, and there'd be all this bird... You know, regurgitation all over the deck, which we had to clean because we had kids coming on in an hour. So we had to swab the decks, hose it down and all that. And we used to curse the cormorants.
Right now I understand your attitude.
It was a sailing ship, so there was a lot of rigging.
Right.
And those guys can perch anywhere on the riggings. So they used to put metal spikes up on the top of the mast.
Yeah.
You know, where the mast is a two-part mast, and it has a wooden seat that it sits in.
Mm-hmm.
So we put spikes around there so they wouldn't sit there. So they'd sit on the steel rigging and the lines. So they were real pain in the ass.
So you were traumatized by cormorants earlier in your
life.
Which is why you're so negative about it.
Except when they go to Chinese restaurants, because you know the story about the cormorants?
No, please tell us.
Well, in Asia, they use the cormorant for fishing.
Uh-huh.
Yep. And what they do is, the cormorant is like a family pet. These people who live in the boats on the rivers, you know, water people they're called, like in Vietnam, and they have cormorants.
Mm.
And what they do is they put a ring around the cormorant's neck.
Oh, to keep the fish from going down the throat.
Yes, from keep the fish from swallowing. And they have their cormorants. They let them go, and the cormorants go all around the route, and they dive for fish, which they're supposed to do, and they come up and have a fish in their mouth, but they can't swallow it because the ring keeps them from swallowing it. So the fisherman takes the fish away, but he does give the cormorant a fish or two,
mm-hmm.
so he doesn't give up hope.
I imagine.
A small fish.
Small pieces.
So
yeah.
he can swallow it. So that's a story about cormorants as a partner to man and helping them fish.
Yeah.
So they're in all kinds of stories and mythology in the Far East. But if you're a boat owner in the Northeast or all that, or even now in the Great Lakes, they become a real pest because their numbers have gone up tremendously. Yeah.
We didn't have cormorants in the Bronx when I was growing up.
Well.
Maybe they're there now. Now, we only had gulls that would poop on the boat. You'd have that same thing. You'd go to pick up the boat and it would have seagull poop or a shell that they dropped. And we'd have I'd have to clean the deck before we could go out on the boat.
Yeah. Okay, so that was good. You had a good time.
I had a very good time. And then Gabriel, the guide, told us about a trip that he's leading to Trinidad and Tobago in April. That's also sponsored by Audubon. It's April 9th to the 17th, so that people can be back for Passover if they're so inclined. And it looks really wonderful. Have you ever been to Trinidad?
No.
I've been to Tobago, which is a very... I was there a long time ago. It was very nice. It was a quiet island. I'm sure it's built up more now. But it was very simple when we were there. We stayed at a hotel on the beach. And at one point, there was no water. We had to haul pails of water up to flush the toilet. But it was an adventure. But it was really nice, with wonderful food and lovely people and nice music. And this trip, I'm sort of interested in this trip to Trinidad and Tobago. I'm really seriously considering going because there are a lot of hummingbirds in Trinidad. And they stay in a lodge... in a nature center lodge for 5 or 6 days and go on day trips in the area in Trinidad. And some of the focus is on hummingbirds, which interests me a lot because we don't see too many hummingbirds in New York.
No, there's only one.
Right. That's it. Ruby throat, right?
Right.
But they have, I think, 14 species in Trinidad. And someone who had been on the trip last year said, you're guaranteed to see 13 of the 14. You might not see the 14th. And then on day seven, you go to Tobago and I guess stay for a couple of days in Tobago and go snorkeling and see the birds and the wildlife there. So it sounds really wonderful. If you're interested, you can go on the New York City Audubon website and get more information and, come along. It should be fun. I think it's only about 15 people.
Mm-hmm.
The price
That's
is
a good size.
The price is not bad. It includes all the lodging, all the food, includes everything. You just have to get yourself down there.
Sounds good. Well, will you be finished with the bed bug book by then, I hope?
No. But that's okay. I can do it. Yeah,
good.
Because I can take my laptop and I can work on it while I'm there. I don't know what stage I'll be on at that point, but I'm well into it. So it's reasonable to believe that I'll be well into it, even if we have a June deadline.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a deadline yet, but it'll probably be June. But I feel okay about it.
Good, and everybody knows now about your hummingbird book.
Well, we'll talk about that because I have more to talk about. I thought we'd take a break because we're just about at a break point, and then I'll come back and talk more about these trips.
Okay, terrific. So here we are back on the air, and we're going to take a little break, and then Carol's going to come back and talk about her hummingbird books and other stuff.
Is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past every Thursday at 12 p.m. as she indulges her curiosities about food, cooking, drinking, and dining of the past by taking a journey through culinary history. Linda interviews authors, scholars, friends, and chroniclers to learn about what was eaten, where, and how, from as long ago as ancient Mesopotamia and Rome, right up to the grazing tables and deli counters of today. The show underscores food as a lively link between present and past cultures. Again, that's Thursday at 12 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, and we are back. Thank you, Jack. And thank you for that beautiful New York music. You found that in about 1 second, I guess, on Pandora, but it was just great. I was happy just listening to the music.
It was very nice.
And I'm back here with Bernie Wides.
Right, back on the air, and Carol is going to continue talking about...
Well, I'm going to talk about another trip that I'm tempted to go on, and then I'm going to talk about another project that I'm working on, just to sort of bring you up to date. This is another trip focused on hummingbirds, which is also very tempting. It's led by David Hemmings, who's a fabulous photographer. He has a website, and we have a fabulous photograph of his snowy owl in my Falcon book. And David let me know about this trip, which is in November, and it's to Costa Rica. And the goal is to photograph hummingbirds, and they are hard to photograph. But it's David and another person, who I guess is also a photographer, Greg Bosco. I don't know him. And they provide the equipment. They provide, because when you photograph hummingbirds, you have to have, like with bats, you have to have extra lights that come on synchronized with when you push the shutter.
Oh, right.
So that you can illuminate them properly.
Like strobe.
Because everything is very fast.
Right.
And so it's to learn how to photograph them in that way, which is very interesting to me. And also to you see a lot of snakes and other kinds of animals, and of course butterflies, which I like to photograph. And they're also going to do a nocturnal photography of an active volcano.
Mm.
So it really sounds wonderful.
And where are they going?
Costa Rica.
Oh, Costa Rica. Oh, yes. Probably Arenal.
The volcano is, yeah. Arenal. Yeah. Right. I don't know where they're staying. I have it somewhere, but
yeah,
anyway, it just sounds great. And David is very kindly going to give everybody a copy of my hummingbird book before they go, which would be really nice. It's a way for them to familiarize themselves and learn about hummingbirds, so that they have an idea of what's going on with them, other than that they're fabulous and beautiful and very small. Have you been to Costa Rica? I'm sure you have.
Yes. In fact, I mentioned Arenal because we stayed at a lodge, and you probably stayed the same place, where you have a view of the volcano all the time.
Mm.
And at night, people say, okay, let's go out and see what's happening, because Arenal frequently doesn't explode, but it shoots out some stones and gravel and smoke and sometimes fire.
Wow.
So it's an exciting place to go to be. And you're far enough away that you're safe. If it's going to blow its top, I don't know. But
has it ever really erupted in a,
I think,
major
years ago.
Way?
Yeah. But I was there probably 10 years ago, and it was fine. It was nice to see it rumbling and grumbling, but nothing bigger than that.
Okay.
And so it should be a good trip.
It should be interesting. And Costa Rica, of course, is where we get a lot of our butterflies from.
Right.
You can visit
the farms.
Right. This time I would do that. And just, I know that there are a lot of wonderful butterflies in the wild there, so that would be exciting to
also
photograph.
Also, we stayed in the cloud. There's a cloud forest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people know about rainforests and dry forests and wet forests. There's a cloud forest. And a cloud forest is up in the mountains, and it's frequently covered in clouds.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's a cloud forest. And we went to a lovely lodge there called, I think it was called Casablanca, because everything was white. And the man who owned it was a former president of Costa Rica.
Hmm.
So we got to meet him and talk to him. And he must have had about 30, 40 feeders out, and the hummingbirds were all over the place.
Right.
It was terrific. You didn't even have to go anywhere, because these hummingbirds were there all the time.
Right.
And that's a great, I remember it as a terrific place for birding.
I went to a place like that, I think it was in Texas, where they also, it's somebody's property, and they have a bunch of feeders out, and they have seats, and you can just...
Viewing places.
Yeah, and it's open. If they have a gate. If they want to close it, they close it. But if the gate is open, you're welcome to come in and sit quietly.
Mm.
And there's all different species of hummingbirds at your disposal.
Yeah, I think I went there too, but I don't remember the name of the people.
I think it was Texas.
In Texas, right.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, Texas is a great place for migrating birds and hummingbirds.
Right, plus they're on their way to Mexico.
Yeah.
Right. So that's another interesting possibility. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is I'm just interested in this project. I met on Friday with Richard Ettlinger, who is a wonderful bird photographer. Photographs other things too, but he's really had a wonderful show of his bird photographs at the museum, which I know you saw. And we have a bunch of his bird photographs in the Falcon book. And he and I have been working on a project about vision. And I pulled in a few people that I knew, that I know who are. We have a guy in the conservatory who is he just retired a couple of years ago. He's a retinal specialist, retinal surgeon.
A surgeon, right.
So I consulted with him, and he wrote a little introductory piece for it. I got my ophthalmologist involved. And some other people who wrote about fish and amphibians and mammals and reptiles. And what we wrote about in the proposal was the special, first of all, the whole notion of vision and how it's different in, oh, and I wrote about insects and birds. So we tried to cover the whole spectrum. And then we wrote about vision in general and the function of the eye. And then for each animal, we wrote about how that animal sees and how the details and the special qualities of that animal's eye.
A bird's eye view.
Right, of all kinds of animals right.
Did you include octopuses and squids in that book?
We did. Judy Weiss did the marine piece.
Right.
And, of course, we just did a proposal, so it was just a little bit.
Yeah.
And then Richard did magnificent photographs of the eyes of different animals and also experimented with what does it look like to the animal. So, for example, we're playing around the idea that dogs see in black and white. So we're playing around with the idea of a photograph of what the dog sees and maybe the dog in color.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a beautiful one of what an osprey sees. So you see the osprey, and then you see the osprey's reflection in the water, and then you see the fish under the water that the osprey is hunting. And so we got some interest in it, but we never really got anybody willing to develop it with us. And so we've been very frustrated. We've been back and forth with it. And we finally got a meeting with the publisher who published Richard's book on Feathered Wings, which is a beautiful photography book. And they do a lot of wonderful books that you've seen around. I'm not mentioning the name in case it doesn't work out, but so we met with his editor there, and he had some very good ideas about it. So I'm all excited about it now, and I ordered some books to take a look at, and the idea is to really write a book that's smart, not just this is what a reptile's eye is like, this is what a butterfly's eye is like, but to really talk about the evolution of vision.
Vision, yeah.
Yeah, which is an interesting topic, something Darwin talked about.
Oh, yeah,
and
right.
There have been a few books written about it. And I mentioned in the meeting that Adrian Dyer, who is a scientist in Australia, was studying vision. He was studying what does it look like to a bee when they see a flower. And he constructed a simulation of, I think it was 400 black straws, representing each of the facets of the bee's compound eye. And then he did photographs, and they also have ultraviolet vision like butterflies do. So he did a photograph of what the flower actually looked like to us, and then what it looks like
to the bee. Yeah, sure.
And he very kindly gave us permission to use that photograph in the bee book. So his photograph is in color in the bee book. And so I mentioned this at the meeting. And when I got home, I had an email from Adrian. You know, there have been a lot of floods in Australia, New Zealand.
Terrible.
They've had terrible problems.
Yeah, New Zealand had an earthquake.
Yes.
Yeah, in Christchurch, yeah.
And he was moving from one university to another. And in the flood, his books got soaking wet. And so my book got soaked. And he said he pulled it out to try to show it to a student, and it was ruined. And so would I send him another copy of the book? So I did, and I told him about our meeting. And he said, lo and behold, he's working on vision.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on vision in birds and vision very much along the lines of what we're doing, and he offered to contribute to the book.
Sounds like
so
terrific.
That was just karma. It all happened
sure.
at the right time. So this is very exciting. If anybody has any, I'm really sort of trying to narrow this down. The editor said I have to write a script.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the way to think about it. And then Richard will illustrate it. Richard will take the photographs to follow the script. And so it's really kind of carte blanche, except it has to be smart and scientific and interesting. And
yeah, well, there's certainly enough on the historical stuff on eyes. Going
what,
back
what
to the little
comes to mind,
insect yeah. and the blind cave fish
right.
that one time had eyes and
right.
have no need for them now. They live in the dark all the time. But they still have vestigial eyes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And things like that.
Right.
So you can, you can talk about Darwin too. I mean,
right.
And you want to make it a scientific approach, of course. So there's plenty there. And if there's anybody listening on the air who has something to contribute, send us a comment on our place for comments.
Right.
And Carol will contact you.
We'll take a look at it, right? Well, you can always email me, cabutler1@verizon.net.
Right, because Carol is not comfortable unless she's writing a book.
I'm really very happy.
That's right.
I'm happy being buried with bed bugs this weekend. It was very
nice. This is a bed bug book. And you think it'll be finished by the summer?
It won't be out. It takes forever. But, I'm hard at work on it.
Oh, good. So then you could start on this vision book, getting it all
right.
together.
Well, I'm taking a pause because I really have to come up with this script for this vision book. I'm thinking of in butterflies, they have, and bees also, they have these light-sensitive cells that aren't really eyes, that are, bees have five eyes. How are we doing on time? Do we? What is he holding up?
I think three minutes.
Okay. Bees have five eyes.
Are they called ocelli?
Ocelli,
yeah.
Right. They have two compound eyes, and then on the top of their head, they have three more of these light-sensitive, not really fully developed eyes. And the thinking is that when the bees swarm, which is when they outgrow the hive, the queen dies or they're too big for the hive, and they have to find a new spot, they fly in a huge group. They hang on a tree
right.
or something.
A swarm,
scout
right.
bees go out in all directions to find a new location. And when they do, they come back to the group that's hanging on the tree or the light pole. We have them in the city, too. And they somehow discuss the places that they've found, and they make a decision which one is best. All of this is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, right.
And then the scout bees lead the swarm to the new location. And the scout bees fly above the swarm. And so the thinking is that maybe these three eyes on top of the head are to facilitate the swarming so that they can follow the scout bee, which is up ahead, and at the same time not bump into anybody.
I think you're going to have so much, you're going to have to narrow it down. Because I'm just thinking now what you said, and I mentioned the octopus and the squid, who have eyes very similar to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's different focusing ways of eyes. We can change the shape of our eye.
Right.
But other critters move the eye in and out like a binocular.
Right, that's
for
right.
For focusing, right? And I thought about the horseshoe crab, this ancient critter. It has like eight eyes. And
right.
they're light and dark receptors and ultraviolet receptors. So that's interesting. And the sea star, or the starfish, has a little eye on the end of each one of its arms.
I didn't even know that.
Yep. Our local one does. Next time you look at a starfish.
I have starfish in my house, so I'll take a look.
But they're not alive,
no,
are they?
No.
You may even remember this from your days as playing on a starfish. A little purple dot at the end
vaguely,
of each
yes.
arm.
Yeah.
Those are eyes.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot.
It's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
The editor said he knows he's dealing with somebody who's studying sperm whales, and that they have their eye is physically the largest eye in the animal kingdom. But Richard and I both said birds have the largest eyes in proportion to their body size than any other animal.
Yeah, you know, if you look at our model in the museum of the great blue whale, it has a tiny eye.
Right.
And for this animal that weighs 40 tons,
right,
it says.
But in absolute terms, it probably it's heavier than anybody else's eye. Well, at least with sperm whales. I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know about sperm,
but you think about blues, you think about birds. And you think about an owl, which is a great example, because they have really huge eyes. Mm. And their eyes are so big that there's not room in their head for the kind of muscles that we have to move the eye around. Because the head is filled with the eyes. And so that's why they move their head like
right.
that.
Right, they keep turning their heads.
To jerk, oh yes, you can't see me, but I'm moving my head like an owl. So, yeah, there's a lot. And butterflies and moths, well, I don't know about moths, butterflies have ocelli on their genitals.
Now, that's a handy place to have it.
Right. So they can see what's coming.
See what's coming and going.
Right. So there's all kinds of interesting things. So it's a little overwhelming, but I just wanted to share this. This is what I'm thinking about and trying to organize and get focused on.
I think John Stewart could do a whole show on that.
Probably so.
Eyes on your genitals.
Right.
You know.
Right.
He has a good graphics department, I noticed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's, you know, a little sideline.
Right.
Okay, so anyhow, I think we're going to run out of time.
Yes, we are.
And I have a bunch of new people that I'm going to say hello to in the next show, because I met them in Belize. And
me too. I invited a lot
yes.
of people who are on the
oh,
boat
good.
And the Audubon people to listen, because I said we were going to talk about the trip. So hopefully we have new listeners today, and we welcome them. We hope that this becomes a habit.
Right. So we're going to sign off in a minute. And next week's show will be on Belize, my trip that I returned from last night. And the week after, it'll be part two. Part one will be on the tropical reefs, and part two will be on dolphins.
Excellent. We look forward to hearing about it.
Okay.
Very good.
See you all soon.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. New York, it spells the thrill of first nighting.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Foods USA. In late March, Dan, Andrea, Patrick, and the Heritage team are traveling to the coldest reaches of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont to help the Cantor family tap sugar maple trees. Then the maple sap will flow down to the sugar house, where it is boiled gently over a wood fire, just as it has been for generations. Just a few days later, this grade A amber syrup will be poured into the beautiful glass jugs and sent to you for pancakes, waffles, desserts, glazing hams, or just drinking by the spoonful. There's only a limited supply, so order today. Each 1-liter bottle is $45, including delivery. Delivery will be at the end of March, and we will notify you of the exact shipping date. Each shipment will include a CD explaining the whole process. You can also follow us on YouTube while we work and bottle. In the meantime, you can head over to the Heritage Radio Network archives and listen to Linda Palacio talk about maple syrup on her show, A Taste of the Past, Episode 12. For more information, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join Wine Impresarios Aaron Fitzpatrick and Brian DeMarco as they dish out on the latest industry news with winemakers and tastemakers on Heritage Radio Network's revamped wine show, Unfiltered. Erin Fitzpatrick, one of the first hosts on HRN with her program At the Root of It, amps up the volume and unfiltered content with co-host Brian DeMarco in this 2011 Redux. True to the original format, Erin and Brian will keep you abreast of current happenings and break down the news and global events, distilling complex into anecdotal stories that inspire. From media and political events to hailstorms in Argentina, no topic is out of bounds. Tune in every week to hear them chat up the industry's biggest personalities and host on-air tastings with visiting vintners and the country's hottest sommeliers. Whether you're an expert or an enthusiast, Unfiltered demystifies wine and lets you know what it really takes to get a bottle from the vineyard to your neighborhood wine shop. Unfiltered broadcasts live every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.